Eric.
Hey, Charles. How are you doing?
Doing great, man.
It's a sunny day in Seattle, man.
Really?
Look at that. You know, now people will complain again that you're filming into the light.
Yeah, that's cool. As long as you can hear it.
Okay, so today we are here with, the future of Visual Basic.
All right.
So it's Lucien and Claudio.
I'm Claudio Rousseff. Lucien.
Pleased to meet you. And I don't know if people know Lucien, but Lucien is a new VB language czar.
Okay.
At PDC, you did a talk, right?
Yes.
And he's very active, on the mailing list, VB mailing list and so on. So I'm really happy to have him on Channel 9.
Excellent.
And then Claudio is from MSR, who has been doing, really cool stuff for the future of VB.
Interesting. Which is what we're going to talk about today, right?
Exactly. So why don't you guys just jump in and say, what is the kind of big problem you're tackling here?
You should start there.
That was you.
Okay. So Concurrent Basic is basically an extension of Visual Basic with concurrency constructs to make it easier to write code that has to do multiple things at once, and either because it's interacting with a web service or something and wants to hide the latency of doing a web request, or because it's trying to coordinate your multiple cores on your machine.
Mm-hmm.
What we've done is basically add some message passing primitives to Visual Basic. So now types and modules can declare channels on which you can send values. And you can either choose to send values synchronously, so you wait for a response, or asynchronously, where you just fire and forget. And then, in addition to declaring these channels, types can declare reaction rules, so methods that fire when sets of messages have come in on sets of channels. And although the primitives are very small, they're actually quite expressive. You can write.
So can you write some code? Because the kind of the real beauty of this is that it fits kind of seamlessly into the VB language, and it kind of it complements like the VB declarative syntax for event handling, right? It's just like it's like a match made from heaven. You hardly see this kind of every day.
Okay.
All right. So
interesting.
And you can see I'm really excited about this stuff.
Can I ask one question?
Of course you can.
Look
at us. That's a great question. I'd say look at us and other people because the camera is not involved in the conversation.
Okay. All right.
It's just recording it. Now, once I develop one that, can actually, with the work you guys are doing at MSR Cambridge, where it can communicate and using machine learning and AI, then talk to it.
Okay. All
right. Right on.
So the simplest example, which some people have seen before, mm-hmm. is a simple buffer class. I have to excuse my handwriting.
No worries.
And here we declare two channels, an asynchronous put channel, which takes a T as an argument, and a synchronous take channel. I can't call it get because that's a keyword in VB, so. Which takes no arguments, but will return a T value. Is that correct, VB syntax?
That's correct.
Okay. And then...
Yes. I love VB. The only disadvantage is that for the whiteboard, it's not like the IDE kind of, plays everything for you. But, on the whiteboard, we need, MSR should work on, like whiteboards with VB intelligence built in.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, we'll have to do it ourselves by voice, Eric.
Okay, so here are the two new keywords we've added, is asynchronous and synchronous.
Okay.
Okay. And you can think of this as declaring, an asynchronous keyword declares a message queue, so think of a mailbox or something, and a synchronous keyword basically declares a request queue. So think of making a phone call, waiting for somebody to pick up and get an answer.
Okay.
But the other thing is, like, the way I look at this, you don't even have to kind of think about it. You can just say this is a method with some kind of, new modifier on it, like public or virtual or whatever, right?
Yeah.
And that's, I think, the beauty. It's just like, just like another method where you put another kind of, thing on it. And
Yes.
In fact, the closest analogy is just like an event declaration. In VB, you can already write, you've got some class form, and has an event saved that takes an argument, as string for location. Mm-hmm. And then later on, you can declare a handler, which will handle that event. But let's go back.
Using the handles keyword.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. So here, all we've done is declare the kind of types of messages that this buffer is going to respond to. Okay. And now we want to actually say what happens when we get some messages coming in. So what you do is you can write an ordering method. So it's going to be actually a function. I'm not a native VB programmer. Function React. Okay, that will take a T that it sees on the put channel,
okay,
and return a T to the caller of take. And this function, all it does is return its T argument and function. Okay, so it doesn't do anything. It doesn't do very much. It's just taking its argument and passing it to its caller. Okay. But now there's a new keyword.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's a borrowed keyword called when, which is similar to a handle statement in VME. And here you listed two channels that it's waiting for. So this method, React, is waiting for a message, a request on take, and a message on put. Okay. So read this as, well, when you see a take and a put, then you can run this reaction, okay, and return the value.
So maybe we should also kind of put the use of this thing. So how do I kind of call this this buffer class?
Imagine you've got a producer thread over here, and it's got some, we've got some buffer in scope, so B as new buffer of string, say, then the producer is going to call b.put to send a string, say hello world, right? And the consumer is going to, that's a consumer thread over here, so separate bit of code, is going to call b.take. Am I jumping around too much here?
No, it's great.
b.take. To block until it sees a put.
So here you see, so that's kind of what I like so much about it, is that when you're using this thing, you're just calling, you know, put and take just like normal methods, right? There's no, you know, it looks like you're just doing a normal method call.
Yeah.
And then inside the definition of the class, here's where you kind of describe, you know, how these things synchronize, you know, how they coordinate. But from the outside, it's just like, you know, you're just doing a normal method call. And so there's, like, for the user, there's no new concepts. It's just, you know, you're calling a method on this buffer. And then, you know, here you specify with that join pattern there, you know, take and put, you know, when this React method kind of executes.
That's called.
So you wouldn't think that a join pattern is a new concept for higher level programmers and continuations? I mean, we all take those terms for granted, but let's talk about that.
You know, the way I look at this is thinking about what are the common problems that we run into that we have to solve through ugly ways at the moment that this makes easier. And I came across one just last week. I was writing something which retrieves data off a web service. It retrieves Seattle traffic maps, actually, because I tell you, my commute is 15 minutes if I leave at 2 a.m., but it's 95 minutes if I leave at 4 p.m., so I really have to keep track.
Wow.
And so how do you do that with a Windows form? You've got the main form, and you have to create a separate background thread which retrieves the worker data. So creating the thread is easy, but how does the background thread communicate with the main form? Answer, well, it's difficult. You might use mutexes, or you might use shared data, or you might use the begin invoke method in a form which does the synchronization. But then you've got more trouble, right? Because if you do an invoke on the main thread, how do you terminate the thread? What if you want to tell the thread to terminate, but then you get a deadlock because you're waiting until a thread terminates, but the other thread is blocked until your main thread handles its message? So even the most very simplest task we have to do, retrieving data from a web service, is actually very difficult to do properly with a nice UI. Now, that's where this is coming in. The handles clause, actually, there's a bit of magic that Claudio hasn't mentioned yet to do with the UI thread and how he marshals it. It means that we don't actually need to do all of this work about blocking the threads and starting them separately. All of that work is now done behind the scenes by the message queue implied by the asynchronous channel. And the synchronization is totally expressed in this declaration. When take and put happen at the same time, it's saying that we've got the data from the web service and the UI thread is ready to handle it. There's no more work needed.
Excellent. Coordination.
Yes, so it's the nice thing is that this is like, you know, it's all about coordination, right? And the nice thing is that you can describe this coordination just like, you know, you just are doing normal method calls. And Claudio already kind of said this, and Lucien, is that this is very similar to the way VB does event handlers, right? Because when you have an event like that, so like here, what was the event there? I cannot.
Scared?
Saved.
Saved. I'm rather scared too.
Very scared. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
My hand writing is atrocious.
Yes. And no, so works. Now when you write a handler for this thing, you write also like, you know, sub, you know, unsaved or something.
Yeah.
And then you can say, you know, handles. And then in VB, you can also say, you know, handles. And you can give a list of events. Right. So this one function or method handles, you know, this event or that event or that event. So that's a kind of, you know, a disjunction of events that handles here. Whereas this guy is the jewel where it kind of takes a conjunction of these channels. And now it fires when that and that and that. So it's like nicely jewel. So that one is like, you know, a conjunction. And this one is a disjunction. So it's like a very natural kind of, you know, complement to the event stuff.
And I mean, another way to look at it is that kind of events are used for doing publish-subscribe things, right? Where you say, well, I'm going to publish these events and then unknown subscribers can come along and listen to them. Mm-hmm. Okay? And so they're going to react to messages that you send out to them. Okay? Whereas the channels are telling you, well, I'm ready to receive messages from external people and I'm telling you how to send messages to me, okay? And then you define your reaction logic, like how you react to those logic locally, to those messages locally using the when clauses on methods.
And so can we do a more complicated example where there's like overlapping patterns and stuff like that?
Yeah,
because you know, that's also a very powerful thing, right? That where, you know, you...
Okay, so we have the classic thing you want to do is like a select.
Yes, right? Exactly.
So you've got... let's say we've got two put methods, right? Put A and another. Well, we'll just call them A and B, right? We'll give them the same argument types. And now we want a method that waits for either an A or a B.
Okay, so you can in the web service thing, you might be, you know, you're doing two. There's two services for traffic information, so you're calling both, and now you're waiting for one to come back.
Okay.
So we do a synchronous wait, and it returns a T. Okay, and now we have defined two patterns on this wait method. So we have.
So the wait is going to pick either A or B, whichever one came first.
Okay, so wait and A. Do you want to be really verbose? So this is a function. And what does it do? It takes a T. It's just like the reaction method before. Like the reaction method before. And it returns a T, and it waits for a call to wait and a message on A. And the body just returns... Okay, and now we define another one, which is exactly the same, except that we replace the A by the B.
Understood. I think people can get
okay.
that. Sure.
So we just duplicate this, ditto for B, right?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I mean, here the example is so simple, they're both doing the same thing in the bottom, but they could be doing something different, like maybe appending, you know, I got this from A and I got this from B, so you know which channel you got.
Yes, or maybe they come in different formats, so yeah. You know, you have to kind of, you know, convert it to kind of a uniform.
Yeah, you might want to show it here to return a sum type rather than just a single type.
Or what if, you know, B depended on A to complete to do something else? I mean, how granular can this be? But anyway, that was sort of. I was saying, look, you could call two web services and say, if this one completes first, do this. But it could be that they're similar services, and you want data from both, and somehow you want to do it asynchronously.
Well, if you want, if you want data from both,
that is even easier.
That's even easier. So now we just return both, and let's say we allow them to have two different values. That's fine. Is that how you write it, maybe?
Yes, it is.
Cool.
So U is U, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we just say, well, now we wait for an A and we wait for a B.
Mm-hmm.
Now we get, of course, there's two arguments coming now. There's a T and a U as U. And then what we're going to get back, well, we're going to get back a pair of T and U. Or, we assume
or you generic. Have some selector function that turns it into an R or something like that, yeah.
Okay, and then in the body, we just return a new pair, T and U, and you can fill in the type arguments yourself.
Interesting.
So now we have one pattern that's waiting for
both.
Synchronous caller and three things, two messages and one synchronous call.
So in the previous example, you know, now that that's like, you know, wiped out again. So what happens to that call to when you kind of, you know, react on the one, say, from A? What happens to the kind of, you know, message from B?
Well, that'll get
does
queued
that stick
up.
On the queue?
That gets queued up. So if another call to wait happens, then it'll immediately synchronize with that one. It can immediately synchronize with that one. If you want to dispose of it, then you could also have another pattern that just waits for a B. You know, you can define quite complicated synchronization logic to throw away messages.
That's sort of originally what I was trying to ask, was that how complicated could we make it?
Yes. Well, I wouldn't say complicated. I would say sophisticated. So,
okay.
So like another pattern that you often see here is that, you know, that these methods kind of send messages to each other to kind of, you know, maintain state.
Yes.
Right. So that's a very interesting pattern. So you don't use instant state, but you kind of, you know, use these kind of the messages, the queue as state, right?
Yes.
And that's a very interesting pattern that you often see here.
So the simplest example would be the one plus
buffer. Yes.
Okay. So we go back to where we were before. So just put up the PowerPoint slide. It'd be easier.
I hear you, but this is channel 9.
Yeah. Okay. So what do we need?
And of course, we will link to your paper and slides so people can have us running a different window.
So we're going to do a one-place buffer. Okay, I'll call that. Okay, so this is a buffer that stores at most one message at a time. Okay, so if a caller calls put and it's empty, then the message gets queued in the buffer. If a caller calls put and it's full, then the message will get the caller will block. Okay, so we make our one-place buffer of T. Now, our put message has to be synchronous.
Right, because if you put something in it, it should block when the thing is full.
It's full.
Okay.
Okay. And our take method is synchronous as well.
Because it should block when there's nothing in there.
That's right. And now, these are both public methods, so that's the API. And then we have two private channels, which we're going to use to record the state of the buffer. So we'll have a private message to record whether the buffer is empty.
Okay.
And a private, this should be private asynchronous. Empty. And a private asynchronous method. Is that right? Yeah, to record the value that's in the buffer. So
yes.
Full
width of T.
T. Okay. And now we describe what happens when people call
take and put, right? Okay, so, well, when it's put and the buffer is empty, okay, well, then we consume the fact that the buffer is empty and we post that it's now full. Okay, so this was a
sub.
No return time.
And then let's do Python-esque here that you don't have to put end sub.
Okay, Python-esque, okay. And now we have a... So what happens now if somebody calls put and the thing is not empty, so it's full. Well, there's no pattern on put and full, so they'll just block. Okay. And then we have a pattern on take and full. And this is just like our original reaction. What returns t?
Yeah, so this is a fun
take
function.
And it... Well, actually, what are we going to do?
Yeah, it's now empty.
Yeah. So this method is allowed to run when the buffer is when someone's called does a pending if it's a take and the buffer is full. Okay? And we receive the value from the full cube. We post that the buffer is now empty and return the value to the caller of take.
Okay.
And then one more thing we need to establish the invariant that the buffer is either empty or full is we need a constructor. Right? So when you do more of the constructor.
Let's put the constructor on top there. Okay. There's still some white space there. Yeah. I mean,
sub new, right? New buffer. Well, what does it do? It just posts the buffer.
It's empty.
Is empty. Okay.
Okay. And when this runs, even though asynchronous is a queue that could notionally have lots of things in it, this code will only ever put one thing in it. And even though full is a queue that could notionally have lots of things, this code will only ever have zero or one things inside full. And it will always have either something in empty or something in full, but never both. I thought I might just say a bit more about how things are wired up here. Both of these functions have got the same... Actually, this one should have been a function.
That should be a function.
Okay, so here, like, you know, with red, I like it. You know, red pen here.
They've both got the same signature, T as T, T as T. This short one should also...
Yes.
It returns type T. And I want to say where they get linked up. Put takes a parameter T, and that was the parameter that was passed to put.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, this guy takes T as T, and this is picking up the T that was inside the full queue, and the return value that we get out the end, this as T, is coming from the take method, because take returns a T. And so when we're doing the accounting of this, making sure that the parameters and the return type match, it's looking at these messages in order. It's figuring one of them is synchronous, the rest are asynchronous, concatenating the parameters and getting the return type.
Yep. So the nice thing here is that, you know, this thing has a one-place buffer, but, you know, there's no instance state, right? There's no kind of, you know, here TT value and a Boolean is empty and is full.
Mm-hmm.
That's all done via message passing and by synchronization. So, you know, with the previous conversation we had with George, like, everything is synchronization. I mean, that shows it here. There's, like, you know, we express the statefulness of the buffer using synchronization by synchronizing with itself. It just... It's like what you do. You send yourself a message saying, hey, you know, you have this value or you're empty.
I think that's getting important. I mean, what we're seeing is people are wrestling with concurrency and thread safety. Every time in the mailing list we have the question, is this thread safe? Mm-hmm. The word thread safe doesn't mean anything on its own. You have to ask, does this behave correctly when multiple people are calling multiple methods at the same time? And the answers are usually just... stick a sync lock block around it and hope for the best. Here we're really not hoping for the best. We're explicitly declaring in the code what the concurrency is allowed. It makes it easier, I think, for people maintaining it and looking at it to understand how things are supposed to be called together. Mm. Also, we're dealing, I mean, here we said that we've got shared state and it will either be put or taken, but we're not having to protect it with other things. Normally, if you have a lock protecting a state, you've got two separate objects. One is the lock object, one is the actual data, and you just have to pep your code with comments to say, hey, everyone, this lock should protect this data, and people don't always obey that. Sometimes they manipulate the data without getting the lock. Here, there's just no way to do it. It's really declaring the intent well.
But at some point there is locking or something going on, right?
Sure.
There's no kind of, you know, so there's some magic in how these joint patterns are implemented. That's kind of where, you know, so can we kind of drill down a little bit? So, you know, Lucien already said how it's kind of hooked up signature-wise, but like, you know, what's going on under the covers, right? How does it work that this thing knows that when there's, you know, put and empty and take and full, that it has to fire this method?
So the crucial thing is that all the channels that are involved in the pattern are actually local to the class. Okay, mm-hmm. So that means that the compiler can actually produce custom synchronization logic because it knows what the available channels are and what the patterns are, mm-hmm. Okay, statically. And the way you can think of the patterns as working, and in fact that's kind of how they do work, is that they're pattern matching over the state of the queues. Right? So this is like these are message queues, and these are basically thread queues. Okay? And the implementation is keeping track of which queues are empty and which are non-empty. Okay? And when you send a message, it looks at the state of the queues and the set of available patterns and decides, well, oh, this message or this request is going to either enable a pattern now, which I can then run by consuming some messages from the queues and running that pattern, or it's not enabling a pattern now, I'm going to have to store up the message or block the caller of the request. So under the hood, actually, there's lots of kind of bit twiddling going on to maintain the state of the queues and a summary of the state of the queues and decide how to dispatch the patterns efficiently. Mm-hmm.
But also, I guess there must be some locking that when, you know, sending two messages at the same time, you know, that you're kind of manipulating those queues, like, in a safe way.
So obviously there's more than one way to implement this, but the way it's kind of implemented at the moment is that there's a lock associated with the buffer object, okay, and it's protecting all the queues in that buffer object. Not all the queues in the system, just all the queues belonging to this instance of the buffer. Okay? And so when you send a message, you basically take a lock, okay, and then you check. That freezes all the queues, essentially. And then you're free to examine what you want to do, how you want to dispatch according to what the available patterns are and what the available messages are. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then when you've made your decision, you release the lock and you proceed. Okay, but that lock is only held for a short period of time because one thing you might be wondering is here, like, well, what happens when I'm executing the body of a method? Am I holding on to the lock as in synchronized methods in Java or in C#? And when you're doing a synchronized call, and the answer is no. The lock is only held long enough to make a scheduling decision and to consume the messages from the queues. Once you actually enter the body of the method handler, whatever, mm-hmm. then the lock has been released. But using these basic ingredients, you can kind of code up your own locks on top of that. So here we're kind of using empty as a lock and full as a lock as well.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yep. And so another thing that's, you know, often a problem with this kind of stuff is how to deal with inheritance. Right, so can I have, like, you know, can these get things, can they be virtual? Can I kind of, you know, have a subtype of one place buffer that kind of, you know, overrides?
So the implementation, concurrent basic does actually support inheritance. So what you could do is, if you wanted to, you could split you could put these two declarations of put and empty messages in the superclass. Because this pattern only mentions put and empty. It doesn't mention take or full. Okay, and then you can have a subclass of the one place buffer that declares the take message and the full message and this additional pattern. So you can kind of modify the synchronization logic in subclasses and add patterns both on new channels that you've declared in subclasses and on channels that you've declared in the previous, in the superclass.
Okay. interested. And again, when you use asynchronous keyword, you're actually creating a channel, right?
Yes.
Right? You're not explicitly saying, anyway, I'm getting...
Yeah, you're not explicitly creating a queue under the hood, that's what's happening.
Perfect.
Yeah. But because you've hidden it behind this language barrier, you know, so here the channels are actually only ever have one message in them, okay, because of the invariant set up by the code. So
in
fact,
general,
you could imagine the compiler optimizing this so it doesn't have a proper queue, it just has a one-place queue for these messages.
Okay.
Heck, Badger, I have an idea, right? At the moment, this is a buffer which only stores one place. I reckon it would be quite easy to change it to store arbitrary number of things if lots of people posted a message.
I'm making you think on your feet.
Can I say what I think I would do?
Sure.
I would...
Didn't we just have that before, though? That was what the other buffer was doing.
I wanted to actually lead something there. So let's make this full method. We'll make it the post in here, and we'll make it public. And that means anyone in the world can post something into the queue. The thing is that the queues are ordered, right? That means that if one thread posts something into it and then posts a second thing into it, they're going to be in the correct order when they get taken out at the end.
You're not really supposed to rely on that, though. Because when you're distributing something, well, yeah. So the implication that they are FIFO queues, okay, but you don't know that the synchronous request queues are FIFO because Windows doesn't actually guarantee that behavior.
Right.
And if you're working in a distributed setting, just because you've sent two messages in order doesn't mean they're going to arrive in order at the
yes, even if it's the same the same process that sends.
They can overtake each other over the network. Okay. So on your local machine, you could probably rely on the fact that these are FIFO queues, but you shouldn't really be doing that.
That makes sense. So we're going to have to actually get used to quite difficult things when we're programming distributed systems. I mean, that's a subtlety that is hard to think of in advance.
Well, but I think maybe you're kind of, you know, assuming too much, right? Because the thing is the fact that maybe you should just not assume that this thing is like, you know, an order thing, but it's just like a set, right? Because whenever there's something asynchronous, as Claudio says, you know, as a programmer, you should just assume that this thing kind of happens, but, you know, it can be in any order. So, I mean, that's what asynchronous kind of says to me, right? It's just that it will happen and it won't block, but, you know.
Also, the implementation is quite a bit clever. So the message that wakes up like a waiting caller might not be the actual message that it gets to see when it runs, when it actually wakes up, because we don't take the messages out of the queues eagerly. We leave them in there in case some other thread comes along and is able to proceed immediately. It will just grab that message.
Right.
Okay. So.
And so there's another thing to say about this.
It's deliberate under specification.
Here we've been presenting a very nice visual basic syntax with the when, the asynchronous, the synchronous. But actually it's a runtime library that you can call from C# as well, right?
Yeah, so there's some history to this project, right? So but it's funny that Eric is interviewing me about this because it was his idea. 2004 or something, we released C Omega, right? And C Omega had basically link was an extension of C# 1.1 with link-like query expressions.
Yep.
So you can think of it as a precursor of link, although the technology was slightly different. And it had
XML literals.
XML literals, which are now in VBE. Okay. And it also had an implementation of the concurrency constructs from Polyphonic C#, which were originally proposed by Luca Cardelli, Nick Benton, and Cedric Fournage, to get their names in. So these are Dorn patterns.
Okay. So this was kind of the last jewel from C Omega that didn't make its way into the mainstream.
Yeah. Mm. So in some ways, VBE with Dorn patterns is C Omega.
With a different syntax.
With a different syntax.
Okay.
So there's still some missing features. Maybe they'll make them.
Yes. But they're more obscure.
Right.
Okay, so this was all pre-generics. This was in 2004, I think. Okay, and I'd been working on the generics runtime in MSR, and I thought as an exercise, actually, oh, actually, maybe we could use this to put join patterns in as a library. Okay, because we've got enough expressiveness now with generics to provide a type-safe implementation of join patterns. So I have this library for doing, for writing these kind of synchronization constructs called joins, which you can download from the MSR website.
Which I recommend to everybody.
Okay. And which is it's kind of similar to the CCR in what it does. And then Eric encouraged me to have another look at putting join patterns into Visual Basic, because by now, at this time, Visual Basic had moved on and had generics in the language, so this means that we can now write these lovely generic abstractions, like a one-place buffer of T, mm-hmm. okay, which is, makes join patterns, even though it's like an orthogonal extension, it makes them much more usable, because you can actually write abstractions that you can reuse in different contexts. Mm-hmm. So then VB is actually built, so a concurrent basic, whatever, is
CB,
which is a pun on citizen value radio, channel-based communication, right? Totally.
Well, that's
showing,
the,
I'm showing my age.
That's the fashion du jour, right? Channel-based programming.
Yeah, that's right.
Everyone's doing it.
Okay, so CB actually uses the joins library as a runtime.
Okay.
So in principle, C# code could actually interoperate with the VB code just by making library calls, which wouldn't have been possible with C-Omega.
Yeah.
And that's the same pattern as we had here. I mean, Link was a runtime library with beautiful syntax. XML literals are a runtime library with beautiful syntax in VB only. Join patterns, another runtime library with beautiful syntax in concurrent basic only, not in C#.
Yes. And I must say, you know, the syntax, you know, because the join library requires quite a lot of boilerplate code. It's not difficult, but there's kind of a lot of stuff that you have to set up to kind of set up the channels and so on, which is not kind of hard. So I still, you know, I think it's extremely usable from C#, but there's a lot of kind of, in some sense, noise that you have to kind of put in that doesn't do anything before you can start kind of writing your synchronization patterns.
It was also less usable from VB, because VB didn't support
statement lambdas.
Well, even I think it didn't even have lambdas at the time. But it does now.
Yeah.
And so you could make the argument that you can still use the library now. And if you want to play with these features, you can certainly use library.
Does VB now have lambda statements or lambda expressions?
The forthcoming release Dev 10.
Dev 10
will have complete lambdas.
And this is geared. This is working on a derivative of VB 9.
It's actually now in VB 10.
VB 10 as well. All right.
So,
cool.
So will this ship in VB 10?
No plans. The exercise here is to really show off what's a really cool technology and to gather feedback from people to see, do they like it? Are these really common patterns that they're programming with? When people start using Azure, they're really going to have to face these web service distributed communication. And if we discover what are the commonest patterns and that people like them, then that would be a strong argument to put them into a future version, but not in Dev 10.
Okay.
I think do we still have time?
Yeah, of course.
So I think there's one feature which is worth talking about. So one thing we haven't mentioned is in our examples, all these patterns always had the synchronous channel in the pattern, right?
Okay.
But
yes.
That doesn't have to be the case.
Yes.
Okay? And this gives a simple way of spawning new threads. So imagine doing, I guess the simplest example is go back to our buffer. So what would that? We're going to make an asynchronous buffer now, okay? But instead of, this is a different color.
That's all right. Or black would be nice.
That's fine.
Black.
That's cool. We're
okay, we're good with that. So let's call this an async buffer, okay? A buffer.
Okay.
So instead of having a synchronous take, so it's got an asynchronous put as before.
I like this blue better.
It's sort of sea blue.
Yeah.
Mediterranean sea blue.
You can't get tie-dye pens, right? The magic marker this was. Okay, so you've got an asynchronous put as before, and now we're going to make the async, the take method synchronous. Okay.
Async.
asynchronous. Okay. So what we're going to do is instead of blocking, we're going to queue a callback. What is it called?
CS function. CS func of t.
Func of t. Yeah.
No. Not angle brackets.
Oh.
Eric, you're doing a good job as IntelliSense.
Yes.
Okay. And now what this? And now we have one reaction rule.
And this would be a sub, right?
And this is a sub because it's not going to return anything. Okay. And what is it going to do? Is it's going to wait for a t from the put and a callback from the take.
Yep.
I mean, you might, if you're a VB, if you're a .NET programmer, you're probably going to call this begin take. T and put a line continuation marker here.
You don't have to do that anymore.
Oh, you don't?
That's correct. In Dev 10, we don't need line continuation.
Excellent.
Okay. And what's going to do is going to wait for a put and a take. So now we get the put contents and the callback, and all we're going to do is call the delegate, the callback on T. Okay, now this pattern is completely asynchronous, right? Because it's only mentioning asynchronous channels.
Okay.
So let's just call T. So now what's going to happen is when the producer calls put and the consumer calls take, because user's not going to block, he's just going to queue a callback. Okay. And when a put and a take arrive on the buffer, they're going to spawn a new thread that runs the callback. Okay, so this is how you spawn a new thread. You don't have to do any explicit thread creation stuff. You just write asynchronous patterns.
Excellent.
Okay. Now, you might think, oh, that's awful. I don't want to always spawn new threads. I want to put things in the thread pool, right? Okay, so as a concession to...
No, I don't.
To pragmatism.
Just joke.
You're allowed to put attributes on your individual reaction rules, or in fact the whole class, that control how these things get executed.
Okay.
And so if I put this thread pool attribute, then that's going to run in the thread pool. But I might have a UI attribute which says, well, marshal this back to the UI thread.
Which is
very useful. Okay. And now you think, oh, but yeah, well, how many of these attributes have I got? In fact, well, these are the user-defined attributes. So all you have to do is write an implementation of a well-known attribute class by deriving from it, provide implementation of two methods for invoking a task synchronously and invoking a task asynchronously, and that's it. So then you can basically interface with all sorts of different threading libraries.
So you give users control over how to run the actual methods.
So basically we've abstracted out the notion of what it means to execute something synchronously or asynchronously, just like synchronization contexts do in the CLR. Okay. And we've given you control to basically control that aspect of individual patterns. So in some ways it's kind of dangerous because you're opening up a Pandora's box. People could abuse this. They could decide not to execute the method at all. Mm-hmm. Right? Or they could decide to duplicate the method call.
It's like extremely asynchronous, right?
Yeah, you never do it. Okay, delay it, procrastinate. Yeah, but it's useful for doing things like debugging or for integrating with UI, you know, the kind of single-threaded nature of the UI, or doing other things.
So how can people play with this? Are you making this available in any form or? Of course they can play with the joins library, but...
Yeah, they can play with the joins library now. Yeah. They just download it.
We haven't released a version of Visual Basic that includes this that people can use. The problem is that we do need to modify the compiler and the IDE and the IntelliSense and the colorizer. And this is therefore...
Yes.
Imagine shipping free copies of Visual Studio to people. We can't do that.
Yes,
yet. We're really looking hard to figure out how we can do it. It might be plugins, I don't know.
But this brings up a good point, because this is actually where the library's kind of targeted solution is nice, because then it doesn't matter what language I'm using. If it's a managed library, I don't need another compiler, right? So, and one of the things we found, Eric, and I was thinking about it a lot this weekend, based on the other expert to expert we just did with Joe.
Yep.
Is I'm starting to see like a lot of solutions that are attacking this from various angles, which is the right way to go. But you know, we should talk a little bit about here why you know we're going at the language level to this degree, and why VB was chosen and whatnot.
All right,
that's an interesting kind of way to go.
Yeah. So one thing I would like to say here is one thing that I like very much about this solution is that it has its roots in the joint calculus. So, I mean, as I always say, right, the mathematicians are always right. Joint calculus is something that the mathematicians came up with, so I know that I can trust it.
Okay.
Right? So that's kind of something that's extremely appealing to me about this. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, I can go and search, you know, for joint calculus, and I find stacks of papers with proofs and everything. So I trust that. So that's one nice thing. The thing with the library versus language, you know, that's a harder question to, because like all the things that are there, like link, XML literals, the joint pattern, you could do it without language support, but it becomes much easier and easier to use with language support. So that's always the balance that we have to...
It's a massive move we've got towards declarative programming. I mean, XML literals, you can construct them imperatively, but it's ugly, or you can construct them declaratively like VB lets you do. It lets the programmers say what they want, not how to build it up.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that you said about the library is that the library will have more failure modes than the actual integrated constructs, because there's lots of restrictions that the library can only check dynamically, which we can check statically. So the channels in a handler have to all be distinct. All have to belong to the same kind of local context, local class. And that you can't check statically when you're doing it at the library.
Sure.
But I don't know. I mean, personally, my opinion is you should give languages the right basic ingredients. So lambdas, you know, anonymous lambdas that do everything. You know, iterators. You know, one thing I miss from VB at C# labs is iterators, because they're very useful to write coroutines. So maybe putting in, instead of committing to a particular feature.
By the way, it's like this is a very interesting kind of exercise. It's quite easy to, or quite easy. It's you can implement iterators using these joint patterns. And actually, they are, well, you're using threads to represent the kind of state of the iterators, but several people have noticed, the C# iterators, you know, when they have several kind of limitations, right? For example, you can only kind of, you know,
one method,
and you cannot have recursion, whereas here, you know, you could, so in some sense, that would be an interesting exercise to use the join library to kind of implement iterators in general. I don't know how efficient it will be, but, you know, it's not sure, because you're only using kind of one thread. You're using the thread to save the stack of the iterator.
Yeah.
But there will always be kind of only one, so it's not kind of spinning up, you know, hundreds of threads. So even you could argue for iterators, you know, you can do it with a library or based on top of a library. So how far, you know, do we push that? So, you know, so what do? When you get these pressures and asks, you know, put something in the language, put it in the library, how do you decide?
Well, I first have to say that iterators have been the single biggest request. In the queue of features, they won't go into Dev 10, but in the queue of features for Dev 11, they're right at the very top.
Cool.
The question about what goes into the language versus what goes into a library, on the one hand, there's the question of the purity of the language. Sometimes you think, yeah, we just want a pure, clean language with nothing in it apart from the minimum. At other times, you have the gradual progression. What patterns are people writing by hand a lot? Then they move into a framework library. Then which patterns of the framework library are they using a lot? Therefore, it moves into the language. And I think with Visual Basic, we felt a special duty to Visual Basic users that they wanted more declarative programming. They did want things to be easier.
Yeah, I mean, the dedicated support for event handling is, you know, a long-standing VB feature that...
Yes.
Exactly in that vein, right? It does make it easier to do event-based programming in the language, whereas C# provides kind of half-hearted support for event-based programming.
What's really important is this policy of co-evolution, that anything that we allow Any time that we make a system so that we can write new frameworks or libraries in one language, we always have to make sure that they're callable by the other .NET languages. Mm-hmm. And that's become even more important now with IronPython and F#. We have to make sure that these things are callable. And of course, this is straightforwardly callable by them because it's pure .NET in the library version.
And you guys, your compiler just produces IL, right?
Yes, so, and calls to that library, to the Jarvis library.
So C# can use this without having it in the language.
In fact, the compiler is even simpler than that. It just doesn't even go to IL. It just produces source to source.
Huh.
So you can do it all source to source.
So maybe you can give a set of regular expressions where people can, you know, search and replace.
Almost. I mean, it does some checking as well, but it doesn't have to generate any fancy IL.
That's really cool. I mean, so what we've seen here really is like, three new keywords to get
actually
to understand.
Two, because one two. Is already a keyword.
That's pretty impressive, man, I have to say. And you use sort of the ones that are most obvious, synchronous and asynchronous.
Yes, but again, you know, it's like, you know, even though, you know, it's like, you know, you might be kind of, you know, longing to use this directly in the language, you know, the Joins library has been out for a couple of years now, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, download it, and then you can take, I think, most of the examples in your paper and just kind of transliterate them by
They're all in the samples anyway.
Yes. Yeah.
Cool. And this is similar to, like, what we're seeing a lot of, which is the sort of message passing coordination infrastructure to deal with concurrency.
Exactly.
Maestro is a DSL written in a C#, basically in C#, right? The C# derivative. That they're doing a lot of, in fact, that you can create explicit channel objects that you then program against asynchronously or synchronously.
Yeah, I mean, they're actually being more ambitious because I think they're trying to enforce contracts so that you use a channel, and the type of message you can send on the channel changes over time as you proceed through the contract.
Interesting. So let's get contracts into VB. So they can Dev 12, man.
Well, also there is like an interesting, it's like what people have been kind of thinking about contracts, but also with contracts you can do actually a lot with a library-based approach.
Mm. That's an interesting thing. I mean, you have to decide how much can be should be verified dynamically by throwing exceptions if it fails versus how much should be verified statically in the compiler. And we've done lots of experiments with this, and it really gets to the point when... I mean, contracts are difficult, and they're very advanced. And when they all go into the compiler, the programmer now has to be aware of quite a lot of difficult stuff. I mean, I actually found Outlook rules and alerts difficult enough, and they're just a simple set of rules. Yeah. And if I had to do that for every class I did, I might go mad. Yeah, there's WSDL and stuff for very simple types of contracts. Anything more complicated than that, I think we need to struggle hard. And I don't think the mathematicians have settled on answers yet.
Which I think is always also a good thing, right? But when the mathematicians haven't kind of, you know, found, like, you know, the answer, it's like always dangerous for us to kind of, you know, bet on something, because, you know, if the guys that, you know, I look for answers haven't found the answer yet, so why, you know, then we should be really careful. And I agree with you in this area of contracts and so on. It's like still wide open. Mm-hmm. In some sense, a little bit concurrency too, right?
Yes.
There's a lot of kind of, you know, process algebras and so on. Also, the kind of experts, the mathematicians, don't have, like, you know, like one winner. So that's maybe why you see so many, you know, you asked that question before. Mm-hmm. I think that reflects, you know, just the fact that, you know, we don't know yet which one is the kind of, you know, the best.
And we might find that there's no one answer. I mean, we'll probably be in a future where they're using special process libraries for video processing and parallel link for other stuff. And this kind of stuff for UI or asynchronous, and then automatic parallelization to harness multi-cores.
Yeah, this whole concurrency stuff is so kind of, you know, broad, right? It's like, you know, we're always trying to find the kind of simple solution, but it's just, you know, there's no simple solution. Mm-hmm. And the problems are, as Lucian says, you know, every domain might have its own solution.
Yeah, and we have to make it as simple as possible, but no simpler.
Yes.
Yeah. And if we try and hide too much from the user, then they just get frustrated. This is clearly showing something to the user in cases where the user does have to be aware of it. or like a UI that doesn't block when it's doing lengthy operations. Really, the user does have to put something into their code for that.
Mm-hmm. And this will make that that pattern easy.
Yeah.
It'll make it easier. I mean, you can still, concurrency is never going to be easy. I don't think, it's not a magic bullet.
Sure.
And it's probably worth pointing out that there are some problems with this approach, right?
So tell us about the problems.
So one is, we still got shared memory concurrency in the hood, right? So if you send off a reference to some stateful object on a channel, okay, we still hold on to it and modify it, then the receiver of that reference is hosed.
So for example, in this very example here, that function might be a closure that holds on to some kind of state, from the person that called
thing. Yes, right.
And now it runs, you said it runs maybe on a different thread here.
That's
so
right.
Now we have a potential kind of bug there because there will be shared state without seeing it.
So then use the notion of linear types.
Well, that's a very good point, actually. I think it would be very nice to be to treat the channel contents as values of linear type, so that once you send it off on a channel, you've lost, that's you've used it, okay. And once you receive it on a channel, you gain the capability to use it. But of course, that really requires either erasure semantics where you've erased that through CLR and then all bets are off when you drop with anything, or a serious change to type system.
Sure.
So and so things like deadlocks and so on I assume that they can still of course happen here.
Yes.
So can you write patterns that will kind of
call take before you do a put on your post.
Yes. Or what happened to me when I played with this is that in the constructor, the one that we saw when the buffer should be empty, you forget to initialize it properly. And it's like, why is this not doing anything? And then it's like, oh, yes, of course, I didn't kind of initialize it in the right state.
It really needs some... we need to think hard about the debugging experience.
Yes.
When you freeze the state of the program and you step through it, you really have to be able to inspect the state of all of the queues, I think.
Well, you got that. You almost, at the moment, you can kind of do that anyway. In fact, it's quite nice because you could imagine, because you have the knowledge of what the patterns are, you can't even say which patterns are about to be, which patterns are almost filled, what the state of each pattern is.
Oh, so you might, in the debugger, it might kind of, highlight the kind of, the
state of when?
Well, the kind of channels that are enabled, so you can see...
The channels are enabled, and which patterns are about to complete.
Yeah.
Like, the library had some code to do that for you, just...
All right, so when you put a breakpoint, it kind of lights up the ones that are about to fire.
That's an interesting point.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Very interesting. Now, one question I have just briefly is... Again, I sort of asked it, but why did you choose VB to play around with? You could have easily written a C# compiler or something else. Is there something specific to the current incarnation of VB that enabled you?
The honest answer? The honest answer is it's Eric's foresight. Okay.
Eric so it's Eric's fault. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just joking. I didn't.
Eric asked me to do this, and I thought, why not? Because we had Wizard support there, and the VB compiler itself is actually quite nicely written to do this kind of thing, because there's a lot of support for doing kind of source-to-source stuff in the compiler.
Mm. Plus that, it nicely kind of, we didn't kind of emphasize that much, but I really, is what appeals to me, is that it really kind of
complements
the event handling stuff. Which I think is I always like when there's dualities and kind of complements. It's like,
I didn't know that at first.
Like yin and yang, it's like, I'm an old hippie, so, that kind of resonates with me.
I mean, truth be told, it's actually simpler than the event handling stuff in VB at the moment, because there's more to event handling in VB than just doing the event keyword and the handles keyword. There's also kind of imperative ways of modifying event handlers and all these things. You rewire, and then there's with events variables. There's actually quite a lot of complexity there, which this is it. This is the whole thing.
That's excellent. Well, it would be really interesting to see what people in the real world think of this.
Yeah, we're really looking forward to hearing feedback. Yeah.
Excellent.
All right. Hey. Well, thanks a lot. So this was, I hope to do more, channel 9s on VB, because, we didn't, we get it. Little chance to talk about the fact that line containers are gone. They're my big friends in VB. Mm-hmm.
You're not taking away RAM, are you?
RAM stays.
Okay, good.
Cool. Excellent, okay. You guys.
Excellent.
Thanks for your time. Great to meet you.
Thank you.